Track 7, Hyper-Nurturing. On this track, we will discuss the various ways families are affected by self-injury. We'll discuss guilt and shock, frustration and misunderstanding, and stronger bond. As you know, treating self-mutilating clients can be a difficult and sometimes hazardous task to undertake. The growing population of self-injuring teens has been described as an epidemic. An estimated 2 to 3 million Americans self-injure. The likelihood of treating a client who self-harms is extensive. On this track, we will examine different aspects of hyper-nurturing to consider when treating a self-injuring client. I feel one of the key areas to consider when treating a self-injuring client is the amount of support he or she will be receiving. Do you agree? Many times these clients need several crisis intervention sessions in the off hours, as you know. Have you found that sometimes clients use this as a test of your commitment? In these cases, the need for constant access diminishes as the alliance is forged. 19-year-old Wendy had been recently hospitalized and did not feel confident in her ability to control herself. How do you feel about giving Wendy your home and cell number, along with the number of a special hotline that she could call if you could not be reached? The therapist on our team who did this received many calls from Wendy, mostly at night, when she felt particularly abandoned and afraid. It was at these times that she said she felt the need to harm herself. Wendy stated, "Those first weeks out of hospital were really scary for me. I mean, I was really terrified. I thought, there's no way I can do this. I'm going to have to go back. I just know it." As treatment progressed, the frequencies of calls decreased, and Wendy can now support herself in the off hours without the aid of the therapist. When Wendy would call her therapist, I'll call the therapist Millie, she took a four-step approach. First, Millie told her that she was pleased that she called instead of acting out on her impulse. Second, Millie also inquired about her internal emotional state, when she recognized the urge, what her thoughts and feelings were, and if she was alone or with other people. Third, Millie then asked her questions about her triggers at that specific time, such as, was she feeling especially lonely that night, or had she gotten any phone calls that upset her? Fourth, Millie then suggested trying one of her alternatives and opted for an additional therapy session that week. Do you have your self-injuring client complete a treatment participation agreement before treatment begins? In this document, you stipulate several things, such as a list of alternatives, an agreement to abstain from self-harm, and minimal cancellations. This agreement serves to organize the goals and terms of the treatment relationship and can provide the structure for a recovery program. However, obviously, if not presented in the "I have your best interest in mind" attitude, with many self-injurers, this formalized approach may hinder the trust bond that is needed to build the relationship. In Wendy's agreement, Millie laid out alternatives for self-mutilation should she feel an impulse. These alternatives included drawing, taking a shower, and writing in her journal. If Wendy completed these alternatives and still felt the impulse to self-mutilate, she would at that time call Millie for a crisis intervention. As you are very well aware, many times clients can feel pressured by this agreement and that your care is only conditional. If you are considering using a treatment participation agreement, perhaps you should also consider preliminary talks with your clients to gauge his or her feelings. Think of your Wendy who is self-mutilating. Would he or she benefit from a list of alternatives in the form of a treatment participation agreement? Or would this formal approach jeopardize your therapeutic relationship? How many sessions per week do you have with a self-mutilating client? Millie negotiated over a period of several weeks with Wendy about the number of sessions to be scheduled. She began with about 3 sessions a week, but that number slowly subsided to 2 and then to 1 as she gained back the sense of stability and confidence. Wendy said, "I feel much more in control now. My impulses to hurt myself are not so strong as they used to be, and I can deal with them most of the time without much effort. Generally, clients who cannot control themselves substantially between sessions may need to be hospitalized until they can be handled on an outpatient basis, as you are aware. Also, as you have probably found, like I, that the mere absence of mutilation is not an indicator that the patient or client is ready to lower their number of sessions. Millie used an attitude of self-control to be established before the number of sessions was reduced. An important concept to consider is not to allow the client to associate the therapist with gratification after harm. Do you agree? This refers to when a client should call you or attend a session immediately after injuring themselves. Wendy at one point came to one of her sessions after just having cut herself. Millie promptly assessed her physical condition and took her to seek medical treatment. She fortified the session that day by stating, "If I had at that point began the session with her fresh wounds, she would have started to associate comfort and me with the pain." Obviously, this prevented Wendy from feeling excessive gratification for harmful behavior. But where you draw the line of support and gratification can only be decided on an individual basis, obviously. One act Millie particularly discouraged during her sessions with Wendy was the display of scars or detailed descriptions of self-injuring episodes. When Wendy did this, she glorified it and diverted attention from the underlying issues. Also, I do not believe in substituting self-destructive behavior with less destructive ones, such as snapping a rubber band on her wrist. In my mind, this only confirms the notion in Wendy that her emotions constitute an act of violence. By utilizing more constructive alternatives, like those described earlier in this track, Wendy could begin to express her emotions in a more mature, controlled fashion. Another tactic I avoided was hyper-nurturing. By this I mean treating Wendy as though she were a child and asking her to purge her home of all sharp objects. I feel this only confirms her belief that she cannot control herself and that she will never be made into an adult. Another hyper-nurturing discussion is whether to include the family or not. What are your clients' feelings? Sometimes it can be counterproductive, as you know. For instance, the client is struggling with his or her boundaries and own sense of identity. In other cases, if the client wishes to exclude a family member, this might indicate a route to the underlying issues. Wendy wished to keep her mother out of the therapy sessions. However, this was a result of Wendy's inability to communicate with her mother, and because of this, Millie moved towards the inclusion of family members. Because Wendy is an adolescent, including her mother became even more important, as you know. If you feel that including the family will not aggravate your client's urge to self-mutilate, you probably are strongly leaning towards having the family included in therapy. Think of your Wendy. If family is involved, could it be causing him or her to self-mutilate more? Or if they are not involved, is this something you should consider suggesting in your next session? On this track, we examined different aspects to consider when treating a self-injuring client and hyper-nurturing issues. On the next track, we will discuss how self-control is essential in treating a self-mutilating client. We'll discuss thinking and behaving in an age-appropriate manner, dissolving the excuse of catharsis, and de-associating activity with frustration. Question 7. What is one example of hyper-nurturing?